Greetings once again to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording in the early hours of the morning, November 27, 2013. This is NAB Briefing number 95, and the title is Concerning Morbido. Before I get into the main subject of the briefing, I want to cover just a couple of details related to things I've said in the more recent briefings. In Samurai in the Snow, I pointed your attention to the genre of Japanese samurai film. You know, it's interesting how the Japanese angle comes up in the GNE, isn't it? It's a matter of fact that the attention of the world went to Japan in March of 2011. I believe on the 11th of that month. And that correction, the initial conditions of correction, began on the 19th of that month. So there is a coincidence, you could say, that associates the 3 years of the initialization of Sophia's correction, that is to say, the 3 years of the GNE, which is an exercise in monitoring that event, a correlation between that and momentous world-impacting events happening in Japan. It's strange that I found myself drifting back to Japan in my memory over these past 2.5 years. Of course, I have very vivid memories of the time that I lived in Japan on two occasions when I was 19 and 20 years old. Although that was a very long time ago, I remember many, many things about those years that I lived in Tokyo, in Shinjuku area, and that I traveled to Kyoto, I traveled to Nara, to Hiroshima, and I traveled in the inland sea of Japan. But in addition to my personal reminiscences, there's something else at play, it seems. I think some of you have picked up on it as well. Some of you in the crew have written me regarding your own fascination with Japan, with Japanese culture, and with the cult of the warrior in Japan, the samurai, or Bushido, I believe it's called. So this Japanese theme plays in and out of the GNE, doesn't it? Recently, I brought your attention to the film Tsushingura, which was a Technicolor samurai action film released in 1962, more than very long film, more than about three and a half hours long. And I described the scene of samurai in the snow. As it turns out, that scene is not in Tsushingura, as I thought it was. Tsushingura is a film worth watching on its own terms, but you won't see that scene, nor will you find it in other Kurosawa films, such as Sanjuro and Yojimbo. Those films with Toshiro Mifune are in black and white. I remember the scene was in color. And Seven Samurai by Kurosawa is also in black and white. So it's difficult for me to say where I actually saw that scene. It might be in Kagemusha, or it might be in Redbeard, but Redbeard is not a samurai film, but Redbeard was a color film with Toshiro Mifune, but it's about a doctor. It's not a samurai film. So I really don't know. I had also thought that it might be in the TV miniseries Shogun of 1980, but it doesn't appear to be in that film either. Shogun can be found on YouTube, by the way. It's in some respects worth watching. It was certainly a high quality, high production TV series based on the bestseller of James Clavell of the same name, Shogun. And in that film, Richard Chamberlain plays an Englishman in Japan, and Toshiro Mifune plays the Lord Torinaga, who turns out to be Lord Torinaka, who turns out to be the Shogun. If you watch it on YouTube, be sure to watch the high definition version, which is in four parts, which is about 2 hours each. It's quite remarkable in some respects to watch Shogun. At the time, it was a revelation, 1980, it was a revelation to the Western world of some of the values and elements of the lifestyle of the Japanese. They are depicted vividly and with close historical facticity during that period when the English and the Portuguese first landed on Japanese shores, and Japan was not yet open at that time. One historical fact that comes to light in Shogun concerns the Treaty of Zaragoza, which is a treaty negotiated here in Spain in 1529, actually negotiated over a decade of time in the early 1500s. And as the film explains, what happened in the Treaty of Zaragoza is that the Western powers who were reaching toward Japan and China, which was called Cathay at that time, virtually divided up the whole world among themselves. This is another story in parallel to the invasion of Central and South America by the Spanish conquistadors, Pizarro, Cortes, and so forth. It's, of course, well known that the missionaries went out with the conquistadors and that they claimed the land in the name of the Catholic Church, while likewise the whole region of the unexplored region at that time of Japan and China, Indonesia and the Philippines was claimed by the first Portuguese and English ships that arrived there. And Shogun explains, and I believe this is correct, that they were able to do that. They did that on the authority of the Pope. And the way that deal works, or worked, was like this. The Pope claimed to be God's representative on earth, the primary instrument and spokesman of the Father God of the Abrahamic religions. And so the Pope, on the basis of this self-assumed religious authority, gave authority to the Europeans to take possession of the lands that they discovered on the condition that they would spread Christianity in those lands. And in return, the church would support them, the invaders, the colonialists, in exploiting the riches of those lands, in looting them, and in enslaving the peoples. So this was the deal that was cut formally by the Treaty of Zaragoza of 1529. What does this reveal? Well, it reveals something that's been coming up lately, strangely, from a number of angles in the discourse on the alternative media. It's come up through this, the topic has been brought up by this World Bank whistleblower, Karen Hudes, H-U-D-E-S, in which she talks about the evil machinations of the Jesuits in the Vatican, and she points to the Jesuits as being almost the ultimate circle of the criminal cabal that is running crime and destruction on this planet. Well, of course, the Jesuits figure very strongly in Shogun, and they appear as the righteous and detestable vermin that they are. What is remarkable here is that it comes to light with a little, with lifting up a few stones and looking under them for whatever might be hiding there. It comes to light that the Jesuits, from their inception with Loyola, were permeated by Jews, and Loyola himself was what is called a crypto-Jew. And so, in Spain, at the time the Society of the Jesuits was founded, there were people called conversos, and these were Muslims and Jews who converted to Catholicism as a cover in order to avoid persecution or avoid being singled out by the Catholic Church, which was growing in power at that time. Of course, the 16th century was also the time of the invasion of Mexico by Cortes, 1520. These events were parallel in the West, the invasion of Central and South America, and in the Far East, the invasion of Japan, and both were supported by the Catholic Church, which was in fact run by the Jesuits. So the Jesuits are the handlers of the Pope and have been for some centuries. Of course, the situation today is that the Pope is a Jesuit. So there you go. I'm just bringing up these facts to point out what was, to my mind, the key observation to be drawn from this ensemble of events, this gestalt. That is, that the Catholic Church, asserting its authority through the Treaty of Zaragoza, was in effect stating the mandate of the Father God, which is typical of the Jewish people. So just as the Jewish people claim to have permanent right to Palestine, the land given to them by God, and they are the chosen ones of God who have a right to possess that land and to dispossess the people who live there. Equally so, the same belief, the same agenda, the same policy can be seen enforced by the Jesuits in the Catholic Church at the beginning of the 16th century. What I conclude from that is that the Catholic Church and the Jewish Talmudic Zadokite faction on this planet are running on the same agenda. And you can go further in that observation if you like, and you can conclude, as some people do today, that the Catholic Church, which is run by the Jesuits, is actually a creation of the Jewish Talmudic Zadokite cabal. And that would seem to be confirmed by these events. It operates on exactly the same agenda of a mandate sourced in an off-planet deity, taking that mandate as the grounds for the authority, which is an illusion, but for the authority that they enforce to loot and pillage and dominate all of the countries and all of the nations of the world. And when the Catholic Church claims that it is Catholic in the sense that it is universal over all the nations, well, you want to translate the word nations into goyim, because that is what it literally means. So goyim is a Hebrew word referring to all of the nations of the world and all of the peoples of those nations, whether they be living in central Mexico, in Peru, in the Amazon, in Japan, wherever. And all of those people in all of those nations are separated from those who rule over them in the name of God. And those who rule over them in the name of God are the Jews and the Catholics, Catholicism being a creation of the Jews in one respect. And finally today, that huge pestilence of Islam, which is equally so a creation of the Jews, used in a most nefarious manner by the Jews to wage war upon the Goyim, or the Gentiles. So this is the world picture that we see today, we're living in today. And if you go back and you look at Shogun, you can see a really critical moment in the development of this picture of global domination based on the agenda of the chosen people and the lordship of the off-planet Father God. I would add as a final observation that you see the enforcement of this agenda. We can even call it the Zadokite / Catholic agenda of world domination. You can see its enforcement through absolute brutality and cruelty, and the use of force in a systematic and sadistic manner. Catholic Church, from its origin, even before it fell into the hands of Jesuit handlers, was responsible for genocide and murder on an enormous scale. So what you find when you step back and look at history and you consider the execution of this agenda of world domination driven by the illusion of religious authority, what you see is a spectacular exercise of the toxic deviation of morbido. Because what you see is men and hordes of men and armies of men and teams of men executing murder and rape on a massive scale. And so I would put it to you that if you want to understand what morbido is in the positive sense, something that I'm going to try to get across in this briefing, perhaps better than I have so far, then I would say you can define morbido as the true power of manhood that is capable of opposing and defeating this agenda of world domination. When morbido in man, when that drive to kill is placed in the service of the Zadokite Talmudic agenda of the master race, and when it goes to serve colonialism and domination of peoples in their native lands, well, the results are obvious. The question remains, is there enough force of the sane and benevolent morbido left in the male of the human species to rise up and counteract that movement, that tendency, that immense destructive wave of sadism and murder? Only Morbido can defeat Morbido. And the difference in Morbido depends entirely on hatred, what the man hates, and on the integrity of the connection to the earth and to the living earth among the male animals of our species. The hatred that streams from the Jewish Talmudic faction and the hatred that has streamed from the Catholic Church over the centuries is like a fume, a choking fume of ammonia and cyanide spreading across the planet. But I ask you, where is the hatred against that agenda? That agenda cannot be defeated unless there are those who hate that agenda, who hate what it does, who recognize it, and hate every aspect of it, from its premises to its methods of execution, and in turn are willing to stand up against that agenda. So we are at the turning point in history right now. I believe it has happened and is happening in these 3 years. We're at the turning point where it can be revealed if such hatred connected with the positive expression of Morbido is possible in this world. And that would not be a theoretical demonstration if it happens. But let me correct my syntax here. I think it is absolutely imperative to use the word hatred for the emotion of sadistic intensity connected with the negative expression of Morbido. Hatred, like racial hatred, hatred of beauty, hatred of freedom, hatred of the indigenous peoples, hatred of the earth itself, hatred of children. And to distinguish that hatred from the positive force of hate. It takes the positive force of hate to protect that which one loves, and to protect freedom and guard freedom, because freedom is not free. So the confrontation unfolding on the earth right now, as the 3 years of initialization of her correction come to a conclusion, would be, in my mind, the confrontation between the hatred of the sadistic spoilers and merchants of death and the positive hate of that heroic faction of mankind, of humankind, that is capable of defeating them. So you won't find the samurai in the snow scene in any Japanese film that I can name right now. My apologies for that little bit of misdirection. Nevertheless, it remains a remarkable synchronicity that the figure of Fabian Bowers appears to be connecting the music of Scriabin with Trishangura, as I explained by reading from the Wikipedia article. It's also remarkable that on the very same day that my house was throbbing with the chords of Scriabin and I was revisiting Trishangura, I was also listening to Karen Hudis, the World Bank whistleblower. And one of the points that Karen Hudis makes in her current discourse, which is getting a lot of traffic on the internet, one of the points she makes is about gold. And she asserts that there is 3 to 4 times as much gold in the world as the official story indicates. And she also refers to a famous story, a famous piece of history, which concerns a Japanese general named Yamashita. And this is the story of Yamashita's gold. So I was also listening to Karen Huda's talk about Yamashita's gold. She explained that the Japanese general Yamashita was the illegitimate son of the twin brother of Queen Victoria. Isn't that wild? Did you ever hear about that? Queen Victoria had a twin brother who was considered to be mentally unstable in some manner, perhaps autistic, and he was shipped off to the Far East, and he ended up traveling around the Philippines between after the First World War, going up to the Second World War, and having a number of illegitimate children, one of whom is this Japanese man called Yamashita. And then Yamashita, in turn, went around collecting gold prior to World War II and giving out bonds to it, bonds to this gold, and collecting this gold on the pretense that he could keep it in a safe place so that it wouldn't get looted and stolen during the Second World War. You can go read Yamashita's Gold. It's a very well-known story. And Karen Huides has been reviving this story lately. Well, I thought it was remarkable on that particular day that I was listening to her. Why? Because at a certain moment, at the end of World War II, in the Pacific Theater, General MacArthur encountered Yamashita and had to take Yamashita under his protection. Well, it would have been Fabian Bowers as aide-de-camp of MacArthur, who served as interpreter between MacArthur and General Yamashita. So this again is another remarkable connection that came up in that one single day in which I was inspired to do the briefing called Samurai in the Snow. But as far as that scene is concerned, I can't find it. And who knows? Maybe I just invented it. Maybe it's a way I picture myself, but it's so vivid that it appeared in my imagination as something that didn't come from me. I really don't know. In any case, if any of you come across it while you're watching samurai films, then give me a clue and I'll pass it on to the crew. So with that half-hour introduction, I want to go directly now back to the subject of Morbido. In doing so, I'd like to read a letter that I received recently from a crew member. This is not just any crew member, however. This is my friend Bill in the United States. He contacted me originally some years back upon discovering metahistory.org. He's a radical ecologist, and he was able to recognize that the message of the Sophianic vision is a message of radical ecology, deep ecology. Now, very few people know even what deep ecology is. You can go look it up. I talk about deep ecology and not in his image. So I was thrilled at the time that someone who knows what deep ecology actually is and lived it would contact me and give me the recognition. So I've always considered Bill to be quite a unique and special ally in that respect. This is how he wrote me on November 17th. "Hi, John. As friend and student, I need to challenge you on a couple of items, ethical in nature, best as I can understand from what I heard on the NBs 91 and 92. It involves where I see deeply personal matters of the tertian overstepping the transpersonal message. Now, normally I welcome and empathize with the personal details you reveal in the NBs, because it reveals the tertian's humanity, pathos, and endearing qualities. However, I feel it crosses a line sometimes. Please clarify if you think I am misinterpreting. First, I hear venting of a purely personal, impulsive, jealous rage. Morbido directed toward any potential thief of your screenplay idea. Your feeling is perfectly understandable given what happened before, but its expression as part of a permanent chronicle for future generations of Gaian warriors is questionable. I expect and welcome hearing of killing rage directed towards psychopaths, but not toward artistic rivals. Second, the spells cast on Emma while she was vulnerable in an OL trance. On the face of it, irresponsible, no? Yet you do not address that aspect in your inclusion in a larger story about the vultures and Morbido. I would like to trust your ethical example, but this makes it difficult. As an aside, the Emma matter continues to weave in and out of your teaching and has been valuable to a point. The significance of Emma to the generation of the Terma is abundantly clear! Nietzsche have such an ongoing significance. Have you considered perhaps it is time to leave the matter behind the GNE? Yes, such a physical record should be made, but have you given thought to editing by someone a step removed from the Turton's personal life? What editorial guidelines would you agree to? In love and Gaian solidarity, Bill. Okay, let's see if I can answer this letter point by point. And let's see if in doing so, I can bring some more light to the subject of Morbido in both its personal and transpersonal aspects. Regarding the first point, let me say that there are deeply personal elements in the GNE. There are things I've said about my personal life, and there are personal insights and questions and things that have troubled me that come and go throughout the briefings. Everyone knows that. On the other hand, there are clearly transpersonal elements in the GNE and in Planetary Tantra. When I introduced the idea of right action and contra-violence on metahistory.org, I was writing in a transpersonal vein, correct? I spoke about contra-violence as a way to direct the transpersonal rage that people in the world feel today upon witnessing what is done by the psychopaths and by the spoilers and merchants of death. I've come up with this word spoiler recently. It's not a very strong word in a way, but I'm going to use it to refer in particular to the Zadokite and Talmudic agenda of the Jews. The Jews are spoilers because they are filled with envy. And envy not only wants what others have, but envy wants to spoil what others have. Envy is not just wanting the same thing that your neighbor has, for instance, a nice house, a lovely car, enough money to do certain things, to dress well. That's not envy, no. That's what René Girard called mimetic desire. The word mimetic being imitative. So Girard pointed out in a little-known work of his called Desire, Deceit, and the Novel, René Girard, who wrote Violence and the Sacred, pointed out that in human society, a huge factor in what people desire comes from imitating the desires of others. So, I see what my neighbor has, and I desire to have the same thing. The same level of affluence, the same level of comfort, and whatever. This is a natural phenomenon in the behavior of the human animal. But in so desiring what someone else has, I do not wish to take away from them what they have, nor do I wish to destroy what they have so that they don't have it. Those two tendencies come from envy. The particular quality of envy is that it is a quality of spoiling. It wants to spoil the opportunities of other people. It doesn't just want more opportunity for itself. It's a natural human trait. Of course, people living in society will want more opportunity for themselves, right? And they will seek to model their advance in society and model the improvement of their lives based on what they see where other people have more or better than them. So if others have more or better than me, I experience mimetic desire. I want to have the same as them, but I don't want to take away what they have or destroy their opportunity to have it. This is what the spoilers do. So to spoil and despoil is evidence of envy. And envy is the power operating through the Jewish Sadducite agenda with the stated aim to destroy the life of the Goyim and to dominate and enslave the Goyim. And that envy comes directly from the Archons. The Gnostics warned us about this. That envy is not innate to the human species. That envy that you see in the spoilers who want to take away your opportunity to live and thrive is an infection in the human psyche from the archontic source. Not too long ago, I had a conversation with Kundry about envy. I think it was at the end of the summer. We were sitting around talking about the five skull crown, and I was showing her my new model of the five skull crown that I drew, which has the large central skull and then two smaller skulls on the right and left side. And one way to envision the five skull crown is to envision it as a headset of the kind that you place around your forehead when you are wiring yourself to a virtual reality machine. So the five skull crown is the Dakini instrument for destroying the powers that operate, for converting the poisons that operate in the archontic headset. So you can picture it in two ways, as an archontic headset virtual reality device and as the five skull crown of the Dakinis. If you picture it in the first instance, then what you have is the central device on this headset, the central module, larger than any other, and that is envy. And I was saying to Kundry that I've reached the conclusion that envy is not inherent in the human species at all. I have reached the conclusion that if you are Anthropos, the genuine article, the genuine subject of this experiment, and if you have not been corrupted by the archontic influence, then you will feel no envy. And I said to Kundry, I'm pretty sure that I would receive a lot of argument and a lot of opposition if I came out with the generic proposition that envy is not endemic to the human species. Envy is absent in the Anthropos. I'm sure I would be vigorously opposed by that on that point, because look around. It does not seem to bear out to be the case. It does not seem to be supported by the evidence of experience, does it? But then I said, in the course of our conversation, I would rest my argument on this point alone. Well, look at me. I'm a human animal. I'm an example of the Anthropos, and I don't feel envy. I've never felt envy. I felt mimetic desire. I felt my own self-generated desire. But I've never felt envy. I've never wanted to take away what someone else has, or even going further to destroy their very capacity to have it. I've never done that. And so if I don't have envy, and I am Anthropos, then what's with me? How can it be? Well, I put it to you that if there is just one human animal who doesn't feel envy intrinsically and innately and never felt envy, then that is evidence that envy is not endemic to our species. You know, so I rest my case there. If you want to pursue that argument, you might be well advised to use the Socratic method of induction, that is to say, to argue from individual to general cases, rather than vice versa. So according to the argument by induction, if there is one individual case of a human animal is totally lacking in envy, you can argue from there that it's lacking in the makeup of the species. Also, I'd like to point out that the antidote to that envy, which would be the Dakini conversion in the Five Skull Crown, is not something that I would specifically name in this briefing. But there are some components of it I can indicate to you. Go look into a book called The Gift by Marcel Mauss, M-A-U-S-S. Mauss was a French sociologist, and he wrote this book in the early 50s. It appeared in French first and then in English in 1954. And it's a description of the behaviors of gift exchange and generosity that are universally present in indigenous cultures. And this book itself provides a weighty argument on the side of my proposition that it is not natural and innate to the human animal to be consumed by envy. On the contrary, you see? And so this book of Marcel Mauss is a revelation. It's a short book. You can read it in a day. It is a revelation of what are actually the endemic and intrinsic characteristics of this animal we call human. Also, I would point out that, and here it gets a little twisty, so let me see if I can be really clear about this. Regarding the libido, I'm proposing that the libido is a death-dealing force, an instinct to kill, predominantly but not exclusively operating in the male of the human species. And this instinct to kill, this drive, is actually the weapon provided in human nature to oppose and defeat the spoilers and merchants of death. But look very closely at how this proposition works. It's a homeopathic remedy. It is like for like. So, if the spoilers put themselves in the position of a master race and follow an agenda to dominate and enslave others, then they have the incentive to destroy the very ability to survive and thrive in the lives of others. They want to take away from others even that very possibility to have anything, including to have the opportunity to live a simple and peaceful and productive life. They want to take away even that opportunity. All right, now turn the mirror around and look into the mirror of evil to see your own goodness. Then you would see that the one force that can defeat them is like a homeopathic extraction of their envy. Because, in fact, what would I like to do? I'll put it in the first person because it's easier. I would like, for instance, to remove from the international criminal banking syndicate not only all the wealth that they have, but their very capacity to generate that wealth. Therefore, you could say that I would like to spoil their life. Now, there are some people, and I really detest these people, who would say, well, that's clear enough, John, but we can't go down that road, can we? Because we'll end up being just like them. And my response to those people who take the higher moral ground is to say, first of all, we are just like them. The only difference is how we act out our drives. So the mojito is the drive that I would enact in order to do what the spoilers intend to do to everyone else. I can look around in this world at people who have more than myself, and I have no problem with that at all. I have my own self-generated set of desires, and I might have some mimetic desires, particularly regarding cars. Okay? If I see someone who has, you know, a pale gold four-wheel drive Volvo, then I have a mimetic desire to have the same kind of car. But I don't want to take that car away from the person who has it and destroy their very ability to have such a car. But that's what the spoilers do. And so when the power to overcome them begins to operate among human animals through mojito, how will it manifest? Quite simply, my friends, by the application of lethal force upon them, or the threat of lethal force, to not only take away from them everything that they have earned by crime and deceit and murder and rape, but to make it absolutely impossible for them to live, just as they wish to make it impossible for us to live. And I put it to you, and I'm finally getting to the point where I can say this, and I feel hugely relieved because it's been hanging over me like a dark cloud. I can finally say that if you want to think seriously about the success of this experiment in her terms, then think about the success that must be achieved by overcoming the spoilers. There cannot be any success of any human society on this planet as long as the spoilers and psychopaths are succeeding in their agenda. So I put it to you, to oppose and overcome them is one of the imperatives for the success of this experiment. Even in her eyes, even in the eyes of the planetary animal mother who dreamed this experiment, what could success be on Aeonic terms? Well, that's a huge presumption. I really don't know, and I'm going to stop thinking about it and stop proposing that you think about it, because I think it's a brain teaser that we can't solve. But who's to say that success on our terms, which can only occur by overcoming the spoilers, might not also be the success that she's looking for? Hence, the mojito is essential to the success of this experiment. This is my argument. Now, to return to Bill's comment about the personal and transpersonal elements, in some instances, I speak purely personally. You know when I'm doing that. In some instances, I am able to distill my language and speak transpersonally. In some instances, I mingle the personal and the transpersonal, and it's a good blend. In some instances, I mingle them, and it's not such a good blend. It gets muddled. That's what you got. That's what's on offer. And I cannot guarantee that at some point in the future, I will not inappropriately mingle the personal and transpersonal elements of this message. Regarding the specific instance that Bill mentions, well, I don't think he's seeing it really clearly. First of all, I have not directed any morbido toward my artistic rivals. David Cronenberg is my artistic rival. He made a film of the life of Sabina, and he got it out before I got my film out and my screenplay. But I'm not threatening to murder David Cronenberg, am I? I accept that I would have artistic rivals, and I am not directing my morbido to them. To steal an idea, to steal a novel, and I've had this done to me, to steal a screenplay, and I've almost had this done twice, is the action of spoilers and people who cannot produce anything of worth out of themselves. If anyone stole my American Grail idea and made it into a film, they would be spoiling my opportunity to do it myself out of my own genius. And that action of spoiling, driven by envy, the expression of people who steal from others because they are incapable of producing anything themselves, which happens frequently in Hollywood, is worthy of a morbido response. And is it a personal application of the morbido? You bet your ass it is. And is there anything against personal applications of a morbido? Do you think it's that I have suggested or proposed that it ought to be restricted entirely to some transpersonal aim for the species, for the earth? Think again. I would ask Bill, if you had a daughter or a friend, say younger than you, could be a man or a woman, and that person was raped and harmed and left maimed and blinded by someone, some psychopath who attacked them, would you exercise the morbido on the attacker if you had the opportunity to know exactly who it was? Would you enact a very personal and private expression of morbido on that individual? Would you? There's plenty of room for personal expression of morbido. They used to call it revenge. And revenge is a good thing. You know, there's a saying, living well is the best revenge. I like that saying, but I would add, living well and sometimes having revenge is really the best revenge. I'm not going to get revenge against David Cronenberg and the idiots who made this horrible film, the people who acted in it, like Keira Knightley, who was completely miscast to play Sabina. I'm not going to take revenge on my artistic rivals. But I will exercise lethal threat against anyone who considers stealing any of my screenplay ideas. And if you don't like that, and if you think that's a misapplication of something that ought to be transpersonal, well, that's your opinion. And I won't argue with you or try to convince you otherwise. I do what I do, and my behavior is the evidence of my belief and my convictions. I'm grateful to Bill for bringing this up, this point. It also raises, it provides me with the opportunity to say something about Morbido. And to perhaps give you some notion of my hesitation in speaking about Morbido. Threat menace is a widespread behavior in the animal kingdoms. Go look it up. Ethologists study the phenomena of threat menace. Threat display. The threat is a menace. Yeah. Threat display is shown by animals. Cats, when the cats here have a territorial spat up the road from my house, they caterwaul and they yowl at each other and they show their claws and the fur on the back, on their backs goes up. This is all threat display. And they don't like to fight because a cat can be very, very seriously wounded in a fight of 5 seconds. It can lose an eye. It can get seriously scratched and infected, and they know that. So they use threat display. But they can back it up. Now, I've stepped into the soup up to my waist by introducing the subject of Morbido. And I have demonstrated threat display because I do what I talk about. I'm not theoretical. Anything that comes from me comes from the authenticity of my experience. I'm not going to prescribe anything that I myself don't do. What we need today is a threat display against, say, the criminal banking system. The reason why things keep getting worse is because they never get punished. They never go to jail. They get fines, which is a joke. That's a bribe, a payoff. But they don't get physically punished. You don't hear about this in the Western world. You do hear it in Vietnam and China. Occasionally, they will execute a banker for fraud. But that's a state activity, and anything that the state does ultimately contributes to deepening the evil of the state, because the state is evil. So I don't support those instances, and I don't celebrate them as a veritable and valid expression of Morbido. Not at all. The only valid expressions of Morbido are coming from individual men and women. And if you're going to make a threat display, you have to be able to back it up. The reason why I'm reluctant to talk about Morbido is because I don't want to talk about how I'm going to back it up. I'd rather talk about how I backed it up, if you get my drift. I have a concern about my own credibility on this subject. I also have the concern that people will object. By the way, bear in mind that I am the worst critic, the most severe critic of my own message. And there is no objection that I've ever seen that anyone can raise against me that I already haven't raised against myself. Okay? I have a strong problem with my own credibility regarding Morbido. If I come out and say that Morbido is not only a drive to kill, but it contains the element of pleasure in killing, I stand open to the argument, say, coming from men who have killed, who have been Vietnam veterans or in the Iraq wars, and who come back and say, oh, killing is horrible. You might think it's a thrill, but when you actually have to do it, it's gruesome, and you don't feel good about it at all. There's no pleasure in it at all. And what is this guy talking about? Who has he ever killed, you see? I could be blown right out of the water at the first moment that I introduced the concept of Morbido by such an argument. Now, I'm not going to counter that argument right now, right here, today. I could counter that argument, and I think I could do it rather eloquently. But I'm not going to do it in this talk. The only thing that I will point out is that those who have killed, men who have killed in circumstances such as the Iraq War or going back to my era in the Vietnam War, were operating in the service of the state, and they were operating in the service of the government and of authorities. They were not operating out of the individual authority of their own conscience. And certainly, if I had to put on armor and guns and go out and kill in order to implement some agenda cooked up by the psychopaths, I don't think I would particularly enjoy that killing either. So what is intrinsic to the pleasure of the morbido is this key factor, that the motive and initiative to kill resides completely in that individual human animal without resorting to any kind of higher authority or any kind of agenda. Now to return to the final point, final 2 points of Bill's letter, because we're getting down to the conclusion of this briefing. The spells cast on Emma. Look, Bill, you could just say you're sick and tired of hearing the Emma story. I can take it. I'm sick and tired of it myself. But I have to point out that there are things in that Emma story that keep coming back to me. There is a resonance that has nothing to do with this woman. I never think about this woman anymore. It's like I said to Emma once in a letter, listen, I know my love means nothing to you and you couldn't care less, but I couldn't care less that you couldn't care less. And as it stands right now, I really couldn't care less about Emma and even about my story with her. But that incident was so revealing. It had such profound lessons in it that I have not yet entirely exhausted the elucidation of those lessons. So time to time they come up. As far as casting spells on anyone, I've had other people write in and object to this. You know, how can you do this? Are you interfering with their free will? And is this what it's all about? And, you know, is it irresponsible? Let me tell you, Bill, it's anything but irresponsible to cast a spell in the manner in which I cast spells. In fact, it's the highest responsibility that I can take as a Nahual, is to cast a spell on another individual. Now, I'm not going to go into the particulars on any briefing or any talk about how I cast these spells on Emma, and there were two of them, and why I cast them, and how the first one was broken, and the second one remains not yet broken. Nor am I going to elaborate in any briefing on the immense lessons that I drew regarding the method of Guyan sorcery from having conducted these spells. I require a condition to talk about that subject, and that is to have people face to face with me. Now, if it happens that I have people face to face with me and this subject comes up, perhaps the conversation that ensues could be recorded, and then I would make that conversation available. But I am not expounding in this monologue fashion for another second about the matter of these spells. Okay? Finally, the last point that you make is that, yes, such a physical record should be made, but have you given thought to editing by someone a step removed from the Turton's personal life? What editorial guidelines would you agree to? Answer, in a word, none. There is no editing of the GNE. You get it, warts and all. You get the navigator, warts and all. My perfections, my mistakes, my presumptions, my arrogance, everything is in the GNE. And it is my wish that those who assume responsibility for this chronicle By passage of command, they observe the wish of the narrator and navigator not to edit anything out, to show it like it came down, in all its glory, and with all its imperfections, and flaws and glitches, all its errors, including those which I do not correct, as well as those which I do correct. Well, such is my wish. So what can I say to conclude this briefing on the subject of Morbido? What do I actually care to say at this time before I let the subject go for a while? Well, how about this? You know, I've been struggling over the last month or 6 weeks or so with questions about the GNE. I don't doubt the experiment in any respect. I think it's fabulous. Indeed, nothing less than spectacular. Also, your participation in it as crew members is stunning and never ceases to amaze me. I regret that I can't respond to you in detail on the many points that you raise as you undergo this experiment with me. But believe me, I recognize your involvement. I recognize the depth of your involvement and your commitment. So my commitment isn't shaken. It's just a matter of method. How can I handle the navigation from this point on? How can I handle it in the best possible manner, you know, optimally, and to elucidate that which needs to be elucidated in the crucial 4 months ahead? Well, I've decided recently that I'm going to shift your attention to the constellations in the area of the Scorpion Scales scenario, as I call it. The Scales, the Scorpion, the Snake Tamer, the Archer are four constellations which are locked into a scenario, as you know. I once titled this scenario, way back in Santa Fe days, The Upsetting of the Scales. The Scorpion upsets the scales. But as you know, in the course of the GNE, I changed that. I changed the language. I changed one key word. The Scorpion resets the scales. Now, you know that the Scorpion is an image of a particular kind of power of the planetary animal mother. She is Mother Scorpion, or Scorpion Mother, whichever you prefer. Right now we are in the shift of Kamala, which is correlated to the constellation of the Scorpion. This morning, before I began this briefing, I stepped out on the terrace and I saw the crescent moon before sunrise that is now moving into the Virgin, then into the scales, and it will return to the Scorpion to complete this Kamala shift sometime around December 3rd. Now, actually, when I was born on December 3rd, those many, many years ago, it was in the concluding phase of a Kamala shift. I was born in the completion of Kamala. Somehow, the power of Mother Scorpion, which is deeply connected with mortal and human love, is also the power that resets the whole human condition. To understand this reset is a huge, huge challenge of the GNE. I'm so grateful to those of you who are involved now and who have followed the method of toggling back and forth between observation and imagination. I'm so grateful to those of you who have the patience to listen to my exposition of the constellational motifs of the bull, the scales, the scorpion, the virgin, and who follow my attempts to correlate them to events, not only in the external social theater of the planet, but also events in the endopsyche. This is our experiment. It is unique. It is magnificent. I have no doubt whatsoever that it will be extremely productive for generations to come. That is why the chronicle of the experiment in written form has to be established. But right now, as we're looking at the next 4 months, I'd like to shift attention away from the bull and the twins, where we've been looking at the apogee movement along with the transit of Jupiter, and concentrate on these other constellations. As you know, the perigee has moved through these constellations since March of 2011. The lunar perigee was located in the Virgin. Then there was a very complex dance of the lunar perigee in the scales. Then it transited into the Scorpion. I've spoken very little about those hits in the Scorpion. Currently, it's moving into the Archer. And at the end of the 3 years, in March of 2014, it appears at the head of the goatfish. So one way you could interpret that would be to say that when these 3 years are completed, and you in the GNE have undergone the initiation entailed to be observers of her correction, to be witnesses to the Nahual of the Wisdom Goddess, when you have undergone that, the sign of what comes after, the sign of the real beginning of her correction, after initial conditions are established, is the rising of the goatfish across the horizon of the human imagination. And that is the arrival of the Kalika War Party. The goatfish represents in its totality the Kalika War Party. So I'm going to shift in the upcoming briefings, shift your vision toward this scenario of constellations representing the reset of the scales. And one thing that I am going to do as well is to introduce into the briefings a key factor of which I have not spoken until now. You know, the constellation of the Virgin has the prominent marking star Spica, which the Egyptians called Mina. This star marks the left hand of the Virgin, and in the left hand she holds the sheaf of cut wheat. As you know from reading Nod in his image, the sheaf of cut wheat represents the entheogenic mysteries. Therefore, the Virgin Isis Sophia was Demeter and Persephone combined of the Eleusinian mysteries, presents to humanity the gift of the sacred plant medicines and the sacred plant teachers, the entheogenic mysteries, Spica in the left hand of the Virgin. The degree of the sign zodiac of the ecliptic corresponding to Spica is 25 degrees of the sign Libra. Now it so happens that when you look above the Virgin, at the constellation that is above the Virgin, there is a dominant male constellation, which is called Bootes, B-O-O-T-E-S, the shepherd. And the marking star of Bootes is Arcturus. Arcturus is a prominent star that every amateur astronomer knows. Why? Because when you are taught to observe the sky with naked eye faculties, you see that the handle of the Big Dipper, which forms a kind of arc, defines a line of sight, and if you follow that line of sight, you come to the star Arcturus. It is a brilliantly white, blazing star that stands above the Virgin. And very often when you see the Virgin in the sky, she's laying on her left side in the northern hemisphere, your eyes are drawn up to the star Arcturus in the constellation of Bootes. What I'm going to show you is the transformation of the constellation of Bootes into the warrior. Transformation of that star, of that constellation, into the figure of the warrior who belongs to the Sophianic vision of this planet. Not the warrior who serves, because service is not in her syntax, but certainly the warrior who defends, certainly the warrior who displays threat, and certainly the warrior who carries morbido. So if you were to ask, is there a particular star in the sky that can be considered the star of morbido, I would say, yes, there is. It's not only in the part of the sky where the bull is located, therefore the morbido is the star El Nat at the northern tip of the bull's horn, but equally so in this other region of the sky, Arcturus is the star of morbido. And the very remarkable fact, and I'll leave you with this fact, is that the stars in the constellations, whether or not they lie on the ecliptic, which is the line of the Earth's orbit around the Sun and the apparent path of the Sun, that is, it is a particularly well-defined track through the constellations, regardless of whether the constellations are close to the ecliptic or they lie above and below it, the stars in all constellations have alignments to the ecliptic. These are called ecliptical longitudinal alignments. And it's a remarkable fact that if you follow the alignment of Arcturus in the constellation of the Gaian warrior down to its point on the ecliptic, it comes to 25 degrees of Libra. That is to say that Spica, the star of the entheogenic mysteries, and Arcturus, the star of morbido, are perfectly aligned. And I propose to you that the understanding of that alignment, as it reflects itself in the human endopsyche and even in the moral structure of human ethics, is a great lesson now to be considered a great lesson. I prefer to say an outstanding lesson to be considered, explored, and elucidated in the 4 months that remain in this experiment.